On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, the Dodgers lose 3 games in a row? Pull the plug? Sell? Tear it down? All of the above? We talk about that. The LA pitching depth, Shohei Ohtani's return to the mound timeline, ? Two D3 baseball teams without any wins, and a little bit of Netflix documentary chat regarding the Red Sox, all that and more on Baseball Barbacast coming up. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that deserves its own Netflix documentary. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and we should have cameras following us around for 162 games.
Yeah, you know, that would probably be, how do they make the 81 and 81 Red Sox interesting? Our lives would really not be anything remotely worthy of a documentary. We are going to talk about the Red Sox Netflix doc, which Jake has started to take a peek at. We have a lot to cover on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. This is going to be quite the cross-section of news and information and takes, and some of which is not fun to talk about, some of which is very fun to talk about, but that's what this podcast is. So we're going to do our best, and we hope this ends up being a decent episode. We have a very special guest coming on later, our old friend Michael Clare from MLB.com, to talk about a story that we certainly did not think would grow to the level of national attention that it did. That is Yeshiva University ending their 100-game losing streak. But before we get to all that, let's talk about a team with a 3-game losing streak, Jake Mintz. Our opener today is the Los Angeles Dodgers.
You cannot spell Los Angeles Dodgers without loss. They have accumulated 3 of said results over the last 3 games. They are here in Washington, D.C., where I am. I was at the last 2 games. In fact, I was at all 3 of their losses over the last 3 days. The Dodgers started this season 8-0, and since then they are 1-4. By Jove, by God. Is it time to panic? Should they pull the plug at the deadline? Should they trade Ohtani for cash considerations? No, obviously not. A 3-game losing streak in April is not cause for panic or maybe even concern. But because the Dodgers are the Dodgers and I have been there, we thought it was a worthy thing to open the show with.
I think that the most concerning thing, if we are going to descend into a level of hysteria over a very good baseball team losing 3 games in a row, is the fact that we are already at the who's starting portion of the season for a team which, even last year, it kind of took a while before we were like, oh my gosh, this rotation is really in shambles. But now, after they needed to have a Justin Robleski's spot start, that was fairly disastrous. I know Landon Knack will be pitching on Wednesday in the series finale against the Nationals. But with the Blake Snell injury, which is at kind of seeming, you can provide a little bit of insight since I know Dave Roberts spoke about it. Snell, coming into the season, one of the debates that we were often having is like, who is the pitcher we are trusting strictly from a durability standpoint for the first 4 or 5 months of the season? And, you know, you could make an argument for Snell based on how he finished. I was a little hesitant to say Tyler Glasnow because of how his season ended last year. But I don't know, that is what we were, the most basic version was just like, which of these guys is going to throw even 150 or is at least going to take his turn every 5 or 6 days over the first few months of the season? And now we already have an answer that Snell is not that, and that has kind of put their pitching in something of a mess in the early going.
So there are really 2 reasons why it has already become ugly. One is that they are committed to Yamamoto and Sasaki throwing on full rest. And what that means is everything just gets truncated. So like Yamamoto threw on Friday, and in a typical five-man rotation, or in a typical rotation, he would be throwing on Wednesday for his next start. He's not doing that because they don't want to do that. I think that's understandable. Everything the Dodgers are doing, we'll talk more about this later, is geared towards October. That is the whole point of everything that they are doing, because they're assuming they'll be there. So why go all in to win games today when they're really needing to win games tomorrow? So that's number one, is the six days of rest situation. The other is that Snell is on the shelf. This would have been Snell's turn in the rotation. He was experiencing shoulder discomfort. Dr. Neil L. Reattach was in town to visit the White House, which we will chat about later. And so he took a look at Snell's shoulder, and they determined he's going to just not throw, and then they'll reevaluate on Monday. I'm a little skeptical. I think that type of shoulder discomfort usually points towards a longer layoff. There's no inside information from my mouth. That's just my inkling. And if that happens, then the Dodgers are facing something of a extended period with no reassuring pitching depth. I think the pitchers who they feel more confident in, and I would say that's Tony Gonsolin, that's like Clayton Kershaw, that's Ohtani whenever he gets back, we'll talk about that. That's Emmett Sheehan even, who was sneaky good before he went down. That group is not going to be ready until the middle of the season. And so right now, it's Wroblewski, it's Landon Knack, it's Bobby Miller. Now, the reason they went with Wroblewski on Tuesday and Knack on Wednesday is that was just their time in the rotation where they were throwing in AAA. And this is a good reminder, right, with spot starts. If you have the A choice, the number one choice to make a spot start, and they start on a Monday, and you find out you need a dude on Wednesday to start on a Thursday or Friday,
like, you can do.
They can't pitch. Yeah. Like, they're not on cycle. And so you're kind of locked into what you have. And that was part of the reason why Wroblewski, who maybe is not the number one choice, made the start on Tuesday and got absolutely blasted by the Washington Nationals. And James Wood, shout out James Wood. So that's all to say, the Dodgers' pitching depth is in a place where I don't feel great about how it looks right now, but it shouldn't matter in the long run as they start to add pieces back and they can just outslug teams relatively often with the offense they have.
Yeah, the last thing I'll say about the pitching is I saw, I don't know if you were there for this, but Clayton Kershaw, I saw, had an interesting comment about where he's kind of at in his rehab. Because again, when you're looking at the depth chart at the start of the season, you're like, well, why do we need to rush Kershaw back? And I think that that's still generally true, partially because of his physical condition. But I was intrigued by what he said about his physical condition, which is essentially the sentiment that his arm is ready to roll.
Yeah.
But he had, I think it was toe and knee surgery over the offseason, that he is still working through that rehab, and so he's not quite ready in that, from that perspective.
So I was standing by his locker the other day after he threw, and he like came in and took off his cleats and was kind of rolling his toe. And I don't want to say grimacing, but he certainly didn't look particularly comfortable with his toe, and that kind of reflects what he was saying. Now, the problem, right, is that if your toe is bugging you, that's going to lead to other compensations within your throwing mechanics that might lead to issues elsewhere. So Kershaw's going to get that toe ironed out before he's ready to roll. Let's talk about Ohtani. Have you heard of him, Shohei Ohtani? On Monday's game, he goes single, triple, homer because he's unbelievable. The pitching situation with Ohtani, I'm fascinated by for a very simple reason. I don't think he is going to throw a pitch in a game before the All-Star break. I just don't, based upon where he's at in his timeline. He has not thrown breaking balls at full gas off the mound. He threw a bullpen earlier this week in which he only threw fastball splitter. I think he said 80% around there. in order to come all the way back to pitching games, he first has to throw those pitches full gas in a bullpen. Then he has to face live hitters. Then he has to do, you know, work up the workload. And I think that based upon where that time, like that's going to take some time, even from now. And when we finish, whenever he's back, if I'm just going to say, let's say it's late July, early August, that's a 23-month recovery timeline, which is very long. Okay. And that raises the question, why is it going to take so long for Shohei Ohtani to come back? And I really have, so the first thing to understand, right, this is his second Tommy John. And second Tommy Johns usually do take a little bit longer and teams are more conservative with that rehab process. Whether that's rational or not, that's a different conversation, a conversation you and I are not qualified to have because we're not medical pitching workload experts, but I've heard from various people in the game who have varying opinions on it, right? So that is built into it. But the 23-month timeline, even with that under consideration, feels really long. And I think that it's one of three options, maybe combined in some respect. One, there was some issue with the recovery. The Dodgers at no point have said the word setback. Okay, there has never been a setback. That doesn't mean that there wasn't some sort of reason to slow roll, and they could choose how to describe it however they wish. And I think that one thing that's worth noting is the offseason shoulder surgery on the other shoulder, right? Slides into second base in the World Series, messes up his left shoulder, gets surgery on that in the offseason. Even though it's not his throwing arm, Jordan, if you get surgery on your foot, it's going to preclude you from doing non-foot related activities, right? Shohei would have had to take some time off with that shoulder. He would have had to build back up hitting at the same time. And so it's understandable to see that that might have, you know, stymied his return to an extent. Number two, and this is the most important one, is the Dodgers don't need to rush it. If Shohei Ohtani was on the Baltimore Orioles right now, I think he would be back in the rotation in a number of weeks. A team that needs a pitcher to pitch effectively. The Dodgers, based upon how stacked this roster is and how many sufficient arms they have, don't need Shohei Ohtani to be in the rotation right now. They need him to be in the rotation for the playoffs and the home stretch. And so because of that, it makes strategic sense for them to slow roll the return. And then the last reason is that the unprecedented demands of being a two-way player are creating potentially more exhaustion on his body and making it harder to find pockets of time and energy in which to build him back up. Those are the three reasons. I'm fascinated by this. As is the case with any Ohtani-related thing, there is no precedent to this. We have never had an MVP-level hitter try and recover from a second Tommy John surgery at the same damn time.
Exactly. And I think that last point is the one that I keep going back to. And Dave Roberts has essentially admitted this over and over, which is just like, we don't know. There's no, you know, Neil Elitrosh has done a million elbow surgeries, and he probably, when the guy gets the elbow surgery, they walk out and he probably gives them a binder that's like, here's what you do. This is what happens. You do this, you follow this, you start throwing then, and then you start doing this and this, and then voila, you're a major league pitcher again in, you know, in 12 to 15 months.
At no place in that binder is there a page that says, you know, choose your own adventure. Go to page 43 if you just went 50-50.
Right. If you just went 50-50 and you're still leading off and you're still, you know, in supposed to be one of the best hitters in the world. So because of that, I don't think anybody knows exactly the timeline, what is required, what is necessary. I think the part that I'm most compelled by, which you sort of touched on, but related to just how Shohei has operated throughout his whole career, which is, do we get to a point where there is a level of, not necessarily disconnect, but like Shohei's like, I'm ready, like I'm good. And like he has started throwing. We see, okay, he's started to throw bullpens. He started to throw breaking balls. He starts doing live VP in the afternoon before the actual games. Like we start seeing those things. If at that point, I could see a situation where Shohei's like, oh yeah, let's go. I'm ready to go. And the Dodgers are still slow playing him because they only care about him pitching for 70 innings from September 1st till the end of the year, or whatever, 50 innings, however many that would be. That's where I think, not that it necessarily be tension, but I can imagine getting to a situation there where Shohei, who essentially has been calling the shots his entire career, certainly in Anaheim and certainly here, he's gotten to decide when he plays. I'm sure other teams In other situations, we'd be like, no, you have to take this off today to do this. I think he, again, he's superhuman. So he's just going to try to do it, play as much baseball as he can all the time. I'm sure he doesn't want to miss multiple games as a hitter to try and go through this stuff. If he can actually pull it off, if he's willing to accept the Dodgers' guidance, even though, as we just acknowledged, who knows what is best in this situation, that's what I'm interested in as he actually does get closer to coming back.
So I asked Dave Roberts this yesterday during his scrum. I phrased it, is there any tension or disagreement or eagerness or frustration on Shohei's part for not being more ready to pitch? Because you're right. At every point in Shohei's career, it's been go, 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 do, do, like act aggressive, be foot.
Keep playing baseball.
Just keep playing as much as possible.
There's no like, oh, I got it. Yeah, he's playing.
Dave Roberts used the word in lockstep, right? Mm. Mm-hmm. And I think for now that is certainly true. I do believe that. However, I do think it could get to a point where Shohei feels ready. The Dodgers, it does not behoove them to have him pitching in games. And I'm fascinated to see how that works out if that time does come. One last point on the Dodgers before we do give the Washington Nationals a little credit for, you know, kicking their skulls in. The defense this week has been bad.
Yeah, it's been bad all season.
And I think that was one of our biggest concerns about the Dodgers entering the year is that the defensive alignment was substandard. I think that has maybe gotten a little bit worse because Freddie is out and that means Kike has to play first and that rearranges people in a slightly suboptimal manner. I think they only have one above average very good defender in the field at any time, and it's just where Tommy Edman is.
Right. Yeah, pretty much, which is, again, that's right. Why you lock Tommy Edman up for as long as you can, because he covers so many holes in that respect. I think that's totally, totally valid. And yeah, that was the obvious thing that you looked at as a roster. Now, they're scoring plenty of runs. I know not as much over the last couple days, but I think that's the other thing. That was my last point about this position player group. The other thing is that it has kind of performed as expected. Like, the stars have pretty much shown up. They haven't all been healthy, and that's why we haven't gotten the full go. As I mentioned, I think a couple of days ago, they've only had one game with Shohei, Freddie, and Mookie in the lineup together. The bottom of the roster, though, has been every bit as bad as we kind of thought it could be, right? Now, that also includes Andy Pages, who has been part of the defensive problems, but also isn't hitting at all. That includes Chris Taylor, who is a complete nothing, right? Rojas, nothing on offense. I guess he's their best defender, right, when he's playing defense, but he is a complete negative on offense. Kike has 4 hits and 4 homers, but, you know.
He is 4 for 36.
Yeah.
With 4 homers.
Runs, right. And then the bigger problem that's kind of eating into, like, the super nature, like, kind of the amazing element of the lineup is that Max Muncy has been bad too, right? So normally Correct. That's one. Now, Michael Conforto being good has sort of helped backfill those struggles, but still, that's where we're not. So all of that is to say, this is also a reason for optimism with the Dodgers to some degree, is once, you know, you get your 3 MVPs healthy and Max Muncy is not, you know, hitting 190, although he'll probably be hitting close to 190, but when he's getting on base at a higher clip than 244, which he usually does, they're going to be in better shape there. So again, this is still should still be one of the 3 best lineups in baseball almost no matter what, but it does fall off pretty hard, and when you have the defensive deficiencies, that would be the other minor concern there. I am interested in this center field. I know they acquired Estuary Ruiz. I'd be curious if he's like someone that's playing defense in late inning games, but I agree. Edman just covers up so much for them.
The Dodgers have all this money. They should invest in cloning.
Sure.
And I would simply clone. How many Tommy Edmonds is the right number to have on your team, right?
Like, I like the idea of having.
This is a question. Yeah. One second. If the Dodgers could clone Tommy Edman, how many Tommy Edmonds would they want? Because you obviously don't want 26 because then he's going to pitch. You obviously don't want 13 because you'd rather have Shohei Ohtani.
Right.
How many guys in this roster would you be like, thanks for the memories, but I'm going to take Tommy Edman number 7? I think here are the players that you want.
6, right? Like, pretty much the whole bench. I guess he can't. Can he catch? Do we know if Tommy can catch?
No. So you need Austin Barnes, okay,
yeah.
or backup catcher. Yeah. But I think you replace the following players with Tommy Edman. I think you replace, ooh, but Kike is goofy. Okay, you replace Kike. You replace Andy Pies.
Yep.
You replace Miguel Rojas, Chris Taylor, and then Hunter Fiducia's spot or whatever, right? So like, and then obviously regular Tommy Edman, like the one that already exists.
I think you have five or six.
Five or six Tommy Edmonds. There was a Conforto argument. He is a good player. Like Conforto is good. Like we believe in him.
Yeah.
Tommy Edman might be better.
Right. To have Tommy Edman is probably a better left fielder. And so even if you're maybe sacrificing some power from the left side because he's better right-handed, but there's an argument there. I think the line's around 5.5 or 6.5 Tommy Edmonds that you would want on even this on this team. I mean, think about how many other teams you would take like 10, you know, but this one, I think
the White Sox would take all Tommy Edmonds but the catchers.
Correct. I think I'd take him over Theis.
This is a hilarious conversation. How many Tommy Edmonds would each team take?
I love this. Didn't know where we were going here. But Tommy Edman is great. And he is still leading the team in home runs. All right, Jake, we do have one more Dodgers topic here before we take a break.
Well, before we do that.
Oh.
For the sake of things. Washington Nationals, baby.
Curly Nets. W's. I mean.
Next gen attitude.
First game, we got Kyle Finnegan inexplicably pitching like it's like the NLCS. Like, hey, dude, we need five outs. You've pitched 3 days in a row. Doesn't matter. This is the biggest game of our season. He gets it done. And then on last night, I mean, James Wood just bullies him. I mean, James Wood is, so, I know Dylan Cruz off to a very cold start. He's finally sort of starting to find it. James Wood, we've talked about him since he came up. It is just a different, very different. It is a different situation. His opposite field power is very freaky. And he also pulled one last night. He is very special.
I was talking to a Dodgers pitcher about this yesterday. I would say like 70% of lefties, maybe more, are trying to pull the ball all the time, right? They're trying to yank it with zip and verve to the pull side, to right field. So when you are facing a lefty who is not that, and you need to adjust your typical pitching approach completely, that's really difficult to do. And pitchers, when facing lefties, are so used to working them with fastballs on the outer half that when you have to go against James Wood, who could just kind of touch it and send it out to the opposite side, it presents a very difficult matchup. He is a special player. The Wood-Cruz conversation is fascinating. Obviously, right now, you lean Wood just because of what he's shown so far this year. But guess what, Nats fans? You have both. So all things are good there. I was impressed with what Mackenzie Gore did the other day against the Dodgers lineup. He looked really good. They're currently still in pesky category, all right?
Yeah.
They're still pesky. But look, pesky is a lot better than bad. One last Dodgers thing before we take a break. They did go to the White House. They went. All of them went. All of the ones who could go. I guess Freddie Freeman didn't go because he's not with the team. And Brent Honeywell didn't go because he's not with the team. But all the relevant Dodgers went, which was a choice. There was a lot of good writing about this. I would go read what Kevin Blackstone wrote in the Washington Post. That was superb. And I'll just kind of echo what he said, which is the Dodgers represent something different about the intersection of sports and American culture than really any other team in America. And that's both because of Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier, but it's also because of the different types of superstars they have had throughout their tenure on two coasts. Sandy Koufax, Fernando Valenzuela, now Shohei Ohtani, and the multicultural, you know, quilt that is America is represented throughout Dodger history. And given the way the Trump administration has specifically sought to delegitimize and deprioritize that reality of American society through the removal of Jackie Robinson's page on the DOD website and various other things that I don't need to get into here, I think the Dodgers going to the White House struck a chord, understandably, with a lot of people. Now, Mookie Betts, I think, got an outsized amount of the criticism here, considering that he opted not to go when the Red Sox won in 2018 and Trump was president, and he changed, I don't want to say changed his mind, but made the decision to go this time. I don't think that Mookie has had his politics change drastically. I don't want to criticize him because he's in something of a lose-lose situation. And he kind of said this is like carrying this as the reality of being Black in America. I think the Dodgers, by organizationally opting to go, put Mookie in an uncomfortable scenario and kind of left him out to dry. Those are my thoughts on the whole situation. Besides Trump mispronouncing Blake Treinen's name, which was just,
what's difficult about this situation is we watch it, and as has been the case with this president for quite some time, the first time, the second time, there were certainly moments that are amusing. And yes, him mispronouncing Blake Treinen's name of all players was certainly one of them. It's difficult and disappointing. It's not surprising, when you consider the scope of how organizations operate. And yes, you can point to other examples and say, well, hey, listen, you want to stand up for something, like you have meant and had these principles over the course of your history. That is totally fair. And I do not blame people, Dodgers fans, non-Dodgers fans, just people who care about this and feel personally disappointed by this is completely understandable.
At the same time, we've reached a point in sportsdom where expecting these behemoth organizations to act as bastions of resistance and cultural change is not, just not going to happen now. It is they're going to be as risk and crisis averse as possible at every turn, right? Yep. Because that's what makes money. And so, disappointed, yes. Surprised, no. All right, let's take a break. And when we get back, we will switch gears about as much as we have ever switched gears and discuss.
This is going to be a hard pivot. Hard pivot, folks.
Two D3 baseball teams with a lot of losses and one win.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. It is time to talk to one of our favorite people. This is a reunion against all odds in some cases, but also perfectly appropriate. Michael Clare of MLB.com, our former colleague, Michael Clare. Mr. Clare, welcome to Baseball Barbacast. How are you?
I am so good. It's so good to see you guys. It's like we're back in the Chelsea offices, running around, scurrying around, making a mess all over again.
We spent a lot of time with Michael Clare back in the old Cut 4 days, which is somehow 7 years ago, 8 years ago.
No.
I feel like I've aged quite a bit, but we are not having Clare on here simply to reminisce. We have Mike on the pod because Mike did some god dang journalism yesterday. Baby, forget Luis. That's what Gonzo's all about. We had a matchup of truly epic proportions. Two Division III baseball teams, neither of whom had won a baseball game in quite some time. It is quite literally the story most up the alley of me and Jordan. However, Jordan is in Ohio, and I am in D.C. covering the Dodgers, and therefore I was not able to be there. Instead of our boots-on-the-ground account, we bring the best boots we could find, and that's Mike. Let's give some background. Why don't we? I shall
Please.
Kick the rock to you, Michael Clare.
So, yesterday in Teaneck, New Jersey, not the home to either team, it was a game between Yeshiva University and Lehman College. It was moved to New Jersey because Lehman College has a natural grass field. It has been cold and rainy all week. They did not think that the field would be ready. Yeshiva University is about to go into Passover break. So if they not play this game this week, it was most likely not going to happen. So they had to get the game in. Yeshiva entered with a 99-game losing streak. Lehman College entered with a 42-game losing streak. And
maybe one day we'll all lose 42.
Exactly. Maybe we can all do it. So this game had blown up. Disarm on YouTube had posted about it. There was a Redditor who I met at the game, actually, and he's a former professional player. I don't want to give more info because I don't know if he wants that public or not, who, like, kept people talking about. So for the last couple of weeks, everyone was like, please don't win a game. Please don't win a game, because if they win a game, then it's all off. But if they kept losing, there was going to be a doubleheader where at least one streak was going to be broken. So yesterday, in like 38, 39 degree weather at first pitch, 30 mile per hour wind gusts, next to Route 4 in New Jersey, in a field with no lights, baseball history was happening.
So I think it's important that we provide a little bit further context about the schools involved here. So for those of you who have been following and listening to us for a while, you know that Division III baseball is a true passion of ours and has always been, of course, because Jake played Division III baseball and I went to a Division III school that was very good at Division III baseball. And so I was around the team a lot. And we got very involved in understanding the scope and the world and the levels of this part of college baseball, which is the technically the lowest level, right? Yes, there's junior college, and yes, there's NAIA, whatever, but it's three for a reason, right? There are nearly 400 Division III baseball programs, and these two, particularly the schools that play, a lot of the ones that play in New York City in particular, because the resources, as Claire just alluded to, the field quality and just the overall access to improving at baseball and the resources that are being put into a Division III baseball program, which are often not very much because, again, it's not like on the SEC network. This is kind of where the oftentimes the teams that struggle the most kind of come from. And Yeshiva in particular is a program, of course, a modern Orthodox Jewish university. That is the student population. This is a school that has succeeded in other sports. Their basketball team has made the tournament and has been a very, very good team. We actually went and attended a game right before COVID, and we sat amongst the Yeshiva super fans, which I know many of whom were in attendance for this game in Teaneck yesterday. But it's important to understand that, like, Jake and I have kind of been following this Yeshiva program for quite some time. Obviously, they have struggled. Yeah.
So I played men's league baseball in New York with their all-time hits leader. Shouts out to Shmuley Goldis. And I do think it is important, like you said, to understand, it's not that it's not a priority. It's that, especially at Yeshiva, you're not recruited in the same way that other programs are. It's how good are the Jews who show up, right? Mm-hmm. How good are they when they get here? Because it's not like you could go to perfect game showcases and, like, get kids to convert, right? That's not how this works. And so they are very limited in what they're able to do. Just, again, one last thing. Yesterday, they entered the day with 29 wins in program history. Total.
Yeah.
Since 2006. All right? Yeah.
So we have known.
That's not good. That's not good.
We have known about the Yeshiva baseball program and their struggles, where they are normally winning, you know, at maximum two or three games a year. But this streak, as it grew over the last few years, it became a thing. We were talking about it before the season. We're like, okay, where's this going to happen? Lehman has had their struggles recently. As I kick it back to you, Claire, one of the interesting subplots of this game is that their head coach, who I believe you spoke to, Lehman's head coach, was on the Lehman team that last won a game, which tells me that the guy's probably pretty young, right? Because that wasn't, I know their last game was in 2023. Tell me a little bit about what you learned about the Lehman program, because that's not something that we're in tune with.
Yeah, he is. Chris Delgado, the head coach at Lehman, so young. I mentioned this to Jake yesterday, but I've never felt older. I approached him to talk to him. Coach Delgado, Mike Clare, MLB, and I was like, I must look like a grandfather to this guy. It was, but he's passionate. His players really love him. Everybody I talked to really respects him. And he really talked about rebuilding the program. And, you know, I asked him, like, what does rebuilding a program mean at a D3 school? Like, the kids are not coming there to play baseball. So how do you rebuild a program? And it's setting expectations. It's creating a culture. It's, you know, practicing with purpose. It's finding roles for all the players. And I think that's something that the players have responded to. You know, one of the things I noticed from both teams, this was, there were some errors, certainly. There were some missed balls, you know, maybe they're not as fast as other guys, bigger, strong as other guys. But barring a couple errors, and some of them could have been easily the wind, you know, there was a play a right fielder didn't get an error on, but the route he took, the ball just kind of soared in the air and took a different direction. There's nothing a major leaguer's going to struggle on that one. The players themselves are not bad. They care. They're good players. But, you know, some of this was off the record, but I'd heard there were some issues with coaching and the program and practices in the past. So really at this level, it seems like Chris Delgado, despite his age, gets a lot of respect from his team. And his plan is, yeah, to rebuild. And he said, we were close to a win so many times, and for us to finally get it, like, that's such a huge thing.
And it's important to understand why these kids are going to these schools and what they're looking for. And I think it is a very difficult needle to thread for the coaches, where you both want to offer the kids a legitimate experience that feels real, while also being sensitive to the limitations that are baked into the operation. No one at Yeshiva or Lehman is pretending like they're going to win the national championship, right? But at the same time, you want to provide an experience that feels worthwhile, right? And that is a very unique level of college athletics, particularly when we talk about the way that college sports crosses over into the mainstream, which is about glory and cutting down the nets and playing in front of 90,000 people in these enormous football domes. This is not that. Right? This is just to play some ball and have a solid time. Jordan?
Yeah, and that's the thing I wanted to say. And I'm glad you provide that context about Lehman, because I think for a while, Lehman was a kind of a regular, not so good program. You know, they were winning 8 to 10 games a year, and you weren't really noticing. It was just a baseball team in a conference and whatever. So what has happened to them over the past couple of years is a new experience, and something that obviously Chris Delgado takes very personally. And to see them kind of try to work their way out of that is very cool. But I think what Jake just said is so important, because yes, at the D3 level, you have these statistical anomalies and these situations that we certainly pay attention to and we notice. And yeah, like it is easy to be like, oh my God, like this team is historically struggling and has all these statistics that like you can't even believe. But what Jake just said is the most important part. Like, we often talk about why we care about D3 baseball and why we want players who are like kind of in between the talent level. Oh, would you rather go sit on the bench at a D1 school and never play, but get to say you played D1? Or would you rather go to D3 and like play baseball? And the beauty of the Yeshiva Maccabees and even some of the other smaller schools that don't have any success is that they just get to play college baseball. And you can't, no matter whether they're winning or losing, they get to have the experience of going and playing 30 to 40 games where they're NCAA athletes, whether you like it or not. And they get to have that experience, and they're probably having a damn good time. Of course, it's not fun to lose 100 games in a row, duh. But they, as Jake said, they understand what they're signing up for. And that is what is beautiful about it, is that they get to play college baseball. A lot of people that don't get to do that.
So I think, Claire, one of my concerns about this whole story is that it would become a punchline, mm-hmm. right? And that's a bummer. The atmosphere at the stadium, the atmosphere at the field, mm-hmm. would you say that it was the game a punchline, or was there genuine support around it?
There was genuine support. Now, maybe the people who came out went, oh, we're going to have a fun time. We'll see some baseball and we'll laugh a little bit. But there were, it felt like a basketball game. It felt like a March Madness basketball game. Part of it, I assume, is because Yeshiva was just in the D3 tournament. So I think a lot of those kids who came out, you know, I talked to them, they said, oh yeah, we've gone to basketball games. We've never come to a baseball game before. But they were doing the hands behind home plate late in the game. And they're doing, you know, they were singing and chanting. And then later, the second game, many of the Yeshiva fans had left. Part of it was, I think, many of the fans were local students whose high schools got out. They came, saw the first game. It was so close. Then it was getting really cold. They left. But there was still a larger crowd than I think are usually at these games. But it tilted a little closer to Lehman this time. And now Lehman's fans were screaming and shouting. And then at the end of the game, those Lehman fans, when they saw that it was 9-5 and they weren't going to win, joined with the Yeshiva fans and were cheering with them. So, you know, was this, it certainly wasn't a joke. Certainly wasn't a joke to the players. One thing I wanted to mention, the way you talked about the athletes, Justin Chamorro got the win for Lehman in the first game. He is a biology major. This is his last game. If you look at his quote, it is, this is the World Series to him. He said, I told Chris Delgado, you're not taking the ball from me. He gave up six runs, pitched in the eighth inning. That's extra innings. I think topped 100 pitches. He's got to go be a PA now after this. He might have to go to grad school. But he's like, this is the end of my career. You're not taking the ball from me if I'm going to lose. I think he said it's going to be on my sword. And how is he going to celebrate? He said he was going to get pizza from his favorite place on 234th Street, Broadway Pizza. So shout out to them.
Perfect.
But yeah,
we call that pitching for your childhood.
Yes. To the players, this is everything. To the coaches, this is everything. I think you guys know it. When I walk on a field to play catch with a friend, I'm getting ready for like my chance in the major leagues. Like it's all right. About the respect you bring for yourself. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, but this it was certainly not a joke for those in attendance.
It's also so cool that, of course, it was a unique circumstance, and of course, the attention on the game, and is part of, I'm sure, what kind of drove the crowds. But regardless of how or why it happened, that's also just a rare thing to have in a Division III baseball game at any level. You know, you say this is not usually even the best teams. It's usually just the parents, right? There's not a lot of people that are going to these games, especially in the regular season. And so to give those players the experience of having fans like that, even for one day, is really cool. So I love that.
And, you know, this is because, so Yeshiva's basketball court is on campus. So, like, people could just walk over and see a game for 20 minutes and then go to their room. Whereas because Yeshiva has no real home field, driving 40 minutes to New Jersey to watch a game, it's not, and it's cold outside. And so there are all these different dynamics that make it more difficult to not have this type of atmosphere. Claire, we have not yet mentioned who won these games.
That's right. So game one, Lehman College won 7-6, eight innings. That's extra innings because it was doubleheader. But Yeshiva took the lead early. They're up 5-4 in the fifth inning. Lehman, one thing I might say is Lehman, work on your base, Ryan, a little bit. Because that inning, the way Yeshiva held on to the lead was a runner picked off at second, a runner thrown out trying to steal third, and a runner thrown out at the plate. Incredibly exciting inning. The Yeshiva fans went wild, but that might have been one of the things. Like they would have had a lot of base runners that inning. It might not have been that close. Then they tie the game in the seventh, push it to extra innings. They get runners. This is one of the things, too, where, like, when you talk about winning, right, and I know this gets kind of baseball-y, but, like, you start to see little things break down late in games. You could see the Yeshiva pitchers were getting nervous. They were starting to walk guys. Runners up first and second, extra innings, a sacrifice bunt. First baseman and pitcher come in. No one's covering first base. That loads the bases. Next batter is hit by a pitch. That ends up being the winning run. If someone covers first base, that hit by pitch just sends them out to first. Nobody scores. Yeshiva then shut down. You know, they still had bases loaded. It was either no outs or one out and, you know, stranded the runners. But, you know, you just see these little things start to happen. It was, I'd say 80% of the fans there were Yeshiva, whether because they attended or because, you know, I talked to a lot of fans.
We got a lot of people. We got a lot of people in that area in Jersey.
A lot of people in that area, but also we got people. 99 game losing streak. A lot of the people who came out were coming out because of Yeshiva.
Yeah.
I met this one guy, Saul Ehrlich, didn't attend. He was in shorts, which I thought was crazy. He took off work. He took off work so he could come out and see this. He's like, I want to see history. So Lehman wins the first one. It's like a huge gut punch to everybody there because they thought they were going to see it. But then game two, Yeshiva takes a 3-0 lead. Lehman scratches two back, but Yeshiva takes care of business. They score four in the bottom of the third, end up going on to win 9-5. It was 9-4 in the seventh. The sun was going down. There was a phone call saying, if the sixth inning takes too long, this is going to have to be the last inning because, you know, the field's kind of almost like a sunken valley because there is route four to the left, and that's where the sun is going down. So once the sun dropped below the highway, the game was going to have to be called. Fortunately, they made it through the whole game, but it was going to be tight. But not a lot of drama in the nightcap, which I think for the Yeshiva fans was probably for the best.
That's fine.
Hey. Yeah, after 100 games, I think they were like, you know what, we'll take the easy win. The closer, the guy they brought in to close the game, was Noah Steinmetz. Noah Steinmetz is the younger brother of D-backs prospect Jacob Steinmetz and the son of Yeshiva basketball coach Elliot Steinmetz. So the family connections are right there.
Yes, that
Yeshiva
one.
Yeshiva said, they said, don't let the sun go down on me. If you are a member of the Jewish community, the symbolism of getting the game in before sundown is perfect. It could not be any more fitting. And I am so happy for both of these programs to get a win. The feeling of winning a game, no matter the level, and we see this in the big leagues, like when the White Sox won last year, they were happy that day. And that is legitimate, meaningful, purposeful joy that deserves to be celebrated and cherished. And the idea that only two players on the Yeshiva team had ever won a game before yesterday is, to me, that's the most heartbreaking thing. That most of these kids had never had that experience. That these teams split the doubleheader yesterday was the best possible outcome. Cheers to everybody involved. I'm glad that this didn't become a punchline and was instead a celebration of a sport that we all love. Jordan, I have no further questions for our honor.
No.
Do you have anything else you'd like to bring up?
No, it's just, again, it's great that I know a lot of people have sent us messages about the situation. We have, of course, been well aware, but it is cool to have someone that was there. Thank you for giving us that perspective. Everyone can go read Claire's full story on it on MLB.com. When we see the D3 world break into the mainstream, it is a little strange for us, but we are happy to have someone who is more than qualified to cover it in many senses. So thank you so much for giving us that perspective, and we will we'll talk to you soon, my dear friend Michael Clare.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. And I just assume that the next D3 Baseball podcast, you're going to talk about how Emerson's going to storm the new Mac next year. So I look forward to that.
Yeah, probably not. Michael Clare, a proud Emerson alum. He knows a little something about below average Division III baseball. Thank you, Michael Clare. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Thank you, guys.
And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. A couple more topics before we get out of here. We teased it at the front end, but the Red Sox Netflix documentary is out. Came out yesterday on Tuesday. I binged the first two episodes and watched some various moments from other points. Here, my number one early takeaway is this. Anytime Tristan Casas is on screen, it hits.
Tristan Casas becoming this character is so interesting. I think we've mentioned this on the show before. We were there when Casas got drafted. He was one of the few people who came to New York. This was before they were, you know, doing the draft where All-Star was, but one of those last ones before COVID and before they changed all that. Tristan Casas was one of the players that came to New York to, I guess, the caucus or whatever, to be a part of the draft. And at the time, he was, I don't think we got to read. At the time, he was, you know, 17 years old, or maybe barely 18 years old. And he was just this big kid from Miami who seemed pretty quiet, didn't seem to be any sort of like a notably different or unique personality. And the degree to which he has unabashedly been himself since he has arrived in the major leagues is very cool. And what I am certainly looking forward to in seeing in this documentary is certainly I imagine a high concentration of Casas.
So the best moment in the first two episodes is Jaren Duran's car battery breaks down outside of Fenway, and he's got the hood open and he's like in the gearbox and like in the guts of the car trying to fix it. and he's like underneath it. He's like underneath the car, and Casas just walks over and gets underneath the car with Duran and is like, what are you doing? Stop. Like, call someone for help. Like, go ask for help. And Duran keeps like futzing around with the car. Casas calls like AAA and asks for help. And there's this great shot where it's Casas asking for help, Duran refusing to ask for help. And it's this very, this perfect juxtaposition of these two people. And then you see Casas go, oh, this is a limousine service? Sorry, I'll make an adjustment. And he hangs up the phone. You know, it's great.
It's just, but again, like, I mean, we'll see what we get this documentary from Casas in particular, but he also is someone that is, what is great about it is oftentimes younger players like this with this kind of personality, like, it's not even that it's like squashed out of them before they get to the big leagues, but it is certainly suppressed and not encouraged to stand out when you are a young player, when you are a rookie. And I do think that that is a change in our sport that is so refreshing. And especially, you know, we benefit from it because we actually get to know what these players are like. Now, not all of them are as interesting as Christian Casas, but when they are, we are glad that they feel comfortable enough to be able to do that.
And I think Alex Cora deserves some credit for letting Tristan be Tristan. The main characters in the doc are, it's a lot of Brian Baio.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of Alex Cora. Duh. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of Casas. It's a ton of Duran.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of Breslow.
Mm-hmm.
And then like a little bit of Tyler O'Neill here and there. It's very interesting how it's done. I would say that it is worth it. There's just good stuff in there. It's just interesting. It will be compelling to both non-baseball fans and baseball fans. It's worth the watch. Like there's a great scene on opening day where it's Red Sox pitching coach Andrew Bailey walking Brian Baio, the opening day starter, through the Mariners lineup and the attack plan for each guy. And that is interspersed with Baio pitching to them. Mm. So you see Bailey's like, Julio Rodriguez, don't put anything middle, you can get him to chase. And it's Baio throwing a pitch, Rodriguez chasing, and then throwing one middle and Rodriguez crushing it, right? Like, it's very that type of stuff that we know happens, but we never see is really compelling to me.
The one other thing I would say about this, about those main characters that you described that I think is cool, and again, I have not watched any of it yet, so, you know, maybe we'll do a more longer conversation once we watch all of it. And obviously, we're going to talk about Jaron Duran more specifically in a second here. But I do think that those people and characters that you describe is a great way to, and probably very well done by the directors to focus on players who, even if last season was an irrelevant season for the franchise, understanding that these people, these players, which includes Brian Baio, who's you know on an extension, which includes, of course, Duran, which includes, of course, Casas. These are important players for, and people, Breslow, Cora, like, these are people that are still going to be such a huge part of the Red Sox story that even if what happened to them last year is not particularly relevant, these will serve as insights, as of course we are now about to talk about with Duran, for the rest of their careers as members of the Boston Red Sox. And that's all you can hope to get out of a documentary where, as we understand, the season doesn't end in a parade or any sort of high drama from an on-field perspective.
Right. All right, let's talk about Duran. Trigger warning here for self-harm, et cetera. There is a very dark personal moment in this where Jaron Duran talks about a suicide attempt he had, I believe, in 2022 or 2023. I went and watched that part of the doc. It's very dark. Just as a warning for people, if you're going to go watch it, it's in episode 4, I believe. And I think we learn a lot about Jaron Duran as a person and the pressures that have compiled upon his shoulder, both from his relationship with his father and his relationship with himself. And I think that there's a longer conversation to be had about how young men, particularly young men in sports, seek assistance for their own mental health problems and whether they are encouraged to do so and showing vulnerability and dealing with failure uniquely in the sport of baseball, which is very failure driven, right? But I also think, like, first of all, kudos to Durant for talking about this so openly. I think that is a very hard thing to do. I think that decision is admirable, and I think will genuinely give people a better understanding of him and a better understanding of how athletes are treated and maybe how us on the public side talk about and to athletes. Mm-hmm. And I think that especially within the context of Boston, which is a high pressure environment, particularly, it might change some of the conversation around it. I think that's a good thing. Now, yeah. I also think given what happened to Durant, that's the wrong way to say it, what Durant did last year, saying a homophobic slur to a fan, I think that moment and his mental health struggles, both of those things are true. We need to be able to carry both of those things in our mind at the same time. And I think that what I learn about Durant in the documentary makes his slur, gives it like a tragic tilt to it, that this person who has experienced that level of like weight on his shoulders would then return that weight and that disdain and that feeling to an extent onto other people, particularly those in a community that have felt that to such an enormous extent. And so like it casted that in a different light necessarily, but gave it another layer that I thought was compelling. And I watched it, those things this morning before we recorded, and I'm still kind of chewing my way through that. But I thought that the way it was covered in the documentary was sufficiently well done and thought-provoking and revealing, and they did not shy away from the multitudes of Jaren Durant that exist. Yeah.
And as I mentioned, I have not watched it yet, so I won't comment on the specifics. But to your point, like, this is also what you would hope a documentary like this would achieve. Obviously, this specific situation with his own experience with what happened last year, with what happened in 2022, and what he's kind of gone through, like, it's not like they picked the Red Sox because they knew they were going to get that story out of him. And then Jaren Durant talked yesterday about how it's not like he went into this planning to open up. I think it speaks to the quality of the work. I'm sure that he felt like he was comfortable and in a position to feel to be vulnerable and to share these experiences. And he's, of course, as we've already seen, it can have a profound impact on just people who are feeling like this is not something that people in high levels of fame and accomplishment and success are dealing with. And I think that is certainly a good thing that can come out of it. But to your point, as we know, that part of the Jaren Durant story last year is what he did and what he said in a very public space, in a very reckless manner, in a very, you know, senseless way. But as you would hope for any of these things, like, these are humans and these things are complicated. These things are hard. And that is probably, you say thought-provoking, but this is also just real life, right? It's not like they made a film about a character that they invented. This is a real person that has been dealing, that has, as we know, had a very interesting experience over these last few years and a lot of really difficult bouts with mental health. So
these two parts of Jaren Durant exist both together and separate.
Yep.
And I think that understanding that is worthwhile. One does not excuse the other. One does not negate the other. They both exist. They are both real. They are both relevant.
Yep.
I would just recommend watch it for yourself.
Sure.
And just see what you think about it. Yep. Other Netflix stuff, it's just good. It's good TV. And if you're listening to this podcast, you like ball, and it'll kind of hit even harder for you, I think. I wish the Red Sox had been more interesting last year, but that they even were able to make them, the specific people, interesting is a credit to the work. Let's quickly go around the league before we get out of here with a couple news, notes, and nuggets.
One transaction, just wanted to mention here, the Brewers made a trade with those Red Sox, acquiring Quinn Priester. Quinn Priester has now...
Quinn Priester,
if you ever see our friend over at the pod on Lansdowne, Liam Fennessy. We had a Quinn Priester-related video that I'm not going to rehash, but it is very funny, and Quinn Priester is always someone that means a lot to us. Anyway, he is now a Milwaukee Brewer because the Brewers' pitching depth chart is decimated, and they gave up like a top 10 prospect in their system, Yoferi Rodriguez, an outfielder, and the 33rd overall pick in this upcoming draft. That is a heavy price to pay for a pitcher in Quinn Priester who has like a career 6 ERA and is not former first-round pick, but hasn't really accomplished anything at the major league level. It speaks to the Brewers probably believing in Quinn Priester, think they can kind of tease something out of him, and that they need someone to throw baseballs right now because, as we kind of mentioned over the weekend, the rotation is not in a great place. So as Milwaukee tries to crawl back into relevance, Quinn Priester will help them. So good luck to Quinn Priester. Chicago native now gets to pitch closer to home. Jake, explain to me, this says on the docket, it says Cody Bellinger versus chicken wings.
Yeah, you know.
What does that mean?
Rivalry of the century. Cody Bellinger had some chicken wings in Detroit and had some tummy troubles. As a result of those chicken wings, missed the game. But then Cody Bellinger, after that, posted a picture on his Instagram of him eating more chicken wings with the caption, I believe, of round two.
Undaunted.
Now, this, you know me, Jordan. This is what I would do.
That's true. But would you post about it?
Probably. If it was that public. And I think this is the type of ferocity that Yankees fans love, right? Cody Bellinger is not backing down when it comes to chicken wings, and therefore will not back down when it comes to October and the cold weather and the going getting tough. He is willing to persevere, whether it is his stomach or his body or what have you. And I think the only way to overcome a fear is to face it head on. And if you think about it, it's kind of like a vaccine, you know? If chicken wings are going to hurt you, you just got to keep just a little bit more, and then you're immune.
I see. You got to build up the immune. Okay, I see.
Dr. Mintz.
Keep having bad chicken wings that are going to make you sick. All right, well, we'll see how that works out for Cody Bellinger. We'll see if he's in the lineup on Wednesday. One more topic, bit of news that we always have to acknowledge when we get the official drops, and we have new City Connects. The San Francisco Giants have dropped their new jerseys. They have already debuted them last night. They are purple and orange and, by their words, psychedelic. This is a very kind of music-forward. This is a lot about the language that they're using around. It's like about rhythm and about like, ooh, like the waves on the jersey looks
just
like the
drugs.
Waves on a vinyl.
Just say drugs.
I haven't said anything about drugs. I haven't said anything about that.
Just say
the point
LSD.
Is, these are funky. These are funky fresh. And the reason why I appreciate these more relative to just any other is what they did last time, which is nothing. Which
terrible.
Is they it was one of the most, I mean, not even inoffensive, just like lack of creativity,
pointless,
like really this is what you could come up with, which is just like a very kind of like faded white and orange, and like there was some bridge motifs last time. It was like, come on, you can do better than that. And yes, ones like these, some people look at them and it's like, this is stupid, and some people are like, these are awesome, let's just do something different. Come on. And they did. And that's great. And I love it. So I'm in.
Good theme. Good color scheme. They look fine. The font choice is a big miss for me across the chest. I know they were trying to go with this like hippy dippy type vibe with the font. It's the wrong font. It looks too much like the Ghost energy drink logo. That to me kind of ruins the whole look. I think the hats are kind of awesome, though.
Hats are cool. I and then just like kind of the generally the purple and orange kind of hits.
Good.
I am intrigued by the purple being Did you see why this is they are purple?
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing.
Because the New York Giants wore purple as a nod to NYU baseball.
Yeah, from like 1913 to 1917. Well, I don't know if it was to NYU baseball. I don't know what the status of the NYU baseball team was in 1915, but it is good to know that the NYU colors have been purple for over 100 years. And that is, speaking of D3 baseball in New York City, how about that?
My take is that they made it purple and then had to find a reason to make it purple.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. But I think these look cool. And honestly, like, Jung-Hoo Lee is going to look cool in anything. this dude could sell anything. So I'm in. And to me, it's just like with these, I just want them to be different. That's all I care about. Because if we're going to go out of our way to make jerseys like this, that's fantastic for me. So I'm in. I think these are above average. I quite enjoy them. So thank you to the San Francisco Giants. I think we still have like four or five more that we're going to have revealed in the coming weeks. So looking forward to that. We have, in terms of other news, I mean, there's a bunch of injuries. Hopefully a bunch of the Padres left the game on Tuesday night. Hopefully none of those are serious, because if they are, that is very important, because as we know, they do not really have any depth whatsoever. But we'll keep an eye on those injuries the news comes out.
Zach Eflin is hurt. The Orioles is another starter.
Yeah.
Goes down for them. That's not ideal, considering how bad their pitching looks.
Yeah, Matt McClain's hurt again. That sucks, because he has been exactly what we kind of hoped, as him and Ellie have been awesome. The rest of the Reds hitters have not. Spencer Arrighetti, I know one of your favorite pitchers, he has a broken thumb, I guess was hit by a line drive during BP, which I guess, you know, we've seen much worse. We've seen guys get clocked in the head during BP. I guess thumb, you would think, all right, well, it could be. Well, no, it's very unlucky. I don't know if it was during like his own team's BP or the other team's BP.
It was during Mariners' BP.
That sucks. So Astros and Mariners trading embarrassing wins/losses over the last two nights. I'm not sure either of those teams are any good, but Spencer Arrighetti is important, and that sucks that he will not be on the shelf, or he will not be pitching for a while. One more bit of news, of course, which is horribly tragic and sad, but was certainly a big story, was there was a roof collapse in the Dominican Republic. I think it was on Tuesday or late Monday night that I think killed over 60, 70 people, including three people with very significant Major League Baseball ties. One of them, Octavio Dotel, the longtime Major League reliever Tony Blanco, who only played 1 year in Major League Baseball with the 2005 Nationals, but had a very incredible career in Japan. And his son, Tony Blanco Jr., is in the Pirates organization right now. And then the sister of Nelson Cruz. This is just a horribly upsetting, tragic event that has, of course, claimed many lives in Santo Domingo, a place that we've spent some time. We know that the Dominican community is a very close one, and the Dominican baseball community is a very close one. And to have it touch someone, Octavio Dotel, who had an incredible career, pitching almost 800 games, of course, known for pitching for, I think, tied with Rich Hill for the most different franchises played for, 13 different major league teams he appeared for. And then someone, you know, close to Nelson Cruz, one of the most important players in Dominican baseball, you know, recent history, and is someone who is still very tied in with Major League Baseball. Yeah. You know, we see Nelson Cruz around all the time. It's a horrible tragedy, and obviously we just wanted to mention that.
And Nelson's sister, who passed away, Nelsie, was, I believe, the governor of her local municipality in the DR, and so was heavily involved down there. Yeah, I mean, it's just hug the people you love, you know? There's really nothing else to say about it, and thoughts go out to all these families and all the people who were affected by it. And, you know, someone like Dotel, who pitched for Edwin Jackson ends up breaking his record, right, for most teams played for. But, like, the amount of people that he was around.
Exactly.
During his career, literally, like, the most different people. So his loss will be felt quite heavily throughout the baseball world. Thank you all for listening to our podcast. Thank you to Michael Clare for hopping on and telling us about Yeshiva and Lehman. Jordan, thank you for blabbering with me.
Thank you to Carter Singh for producing. And we will be back on Friday. Email us baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Thank you all for listening. Talk to you soon.